Working with refugees, I witness the pains that can come when communities are left behind on scientific and technological advances. In the 1990s in Chiapas, Mexico, I spent time in many villages that had no electricity. As an example of the simple tools available in their regular life, with hand machetes, campesinos spent hours toiling in the hot sun working on corn crops. And as an example of how tough this is, one time I was there when there was a fire a couple fields over, so the threat was high, and leaders decided to clear out a line of brush in order to create a barrier to the threatening fires, and I offered to jump in, and 10-year-olds were working twice as effectively and fast as I was. They're just used to the simple tools. I was used to a lawnmower, a gas lawnmower. With no phones or email, the people of this village struggled to figure out the best place to sell their products for a fair price. Where are we going to take this corn we worked so hard on to sell? It's a guess. We'll get on a bus and see if it works. And this communication challenge impeded many other aspects of their lives. And over the last decades, I kept up to some extent with the progress of these communities. And interestingly, most homes never did get landline phones. However, the Mexican villages eventually did get electricity, and many folks obtained cell phones, the new invention. They leapfrogged over an entire stage of communications technology, and the cell phone helped them not only to plan their business affairs, but also keep in touch with loved ones back in Guatemala, socialize in their village, feel more comfortable in arranging medical care. We live in tumultuous times. Right now, some folks are struggling to find tangible reasons for hopefulness in our country and in our world. So today, we take a step back and lift up how science engenders hope. The religious community, people of faith, should pay attention and give thanks when something happens, like a cell phone is invented and made available to help poor communities around the globe to be more effective and comfortable in their living. Ian Barber started teaching about the relationship between religion and science at Carleton College in 1955, 60 years ago, in small town Minnesota. It was pretty radical for this guy to be arguing that religion and science don't have to conflict with each other, but can have a synergistic positive impact on people's lives. And over his 60-year career, bless his heart, he died 2 years ago, Mr. Barber was pleased when he was joined publicly in his campaign by people like the Dalai Lama, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and thousands of religious and scientific leaders around the globe, promoting constructive, hopeful engagement between science and religion. This effort actually goes back centuries, and as Unitarian Universalists, we should be proud of our tradition of faithfully bringing hope into being with sciences. As far back as the year 1550, the brave and bright Unitarian theologian and scientist Michael Servetus vociferously argued that the Bible did not support the Trinity. He argued that it promoted one unified God, and this view eventually led him to be burned at the stake under the order of Calvin. However, Mr. Servetus was equally well known for having discovered and published the first correctly documented ideas on pulmonary circulation, which is the system that carries deoxygenated blood away from the heart to the lungs and then returns oxygen-rich blood back to the heart. Important to know about when you're trying to help people as a doctor. In 1774, an equally scientific-minded Unitarian minister, Joseph Priestley, discovered oxygen. I actually don't fully understand how Servetus made his discovery without knowing what oxygen was, but that's something we could Somebody could explain that to me later. But it was a Unitarian minister who discovered oxygen. He was actually the leader who helped to found the first Unitarian Church of Philadelphia downtown in 1776, one of the first two Unitarian churches in the country. And I think we should give thanks for the fact that in discovering the functions of blood circulation and oxygen, Unitarian leaders helped advance human well-being around the world. They saw religion and science like this way before their time. The strong affinity between science and Unitarian and Universalist religious education was highlighted in 1925 with the Scopes trial, also known as the Monkey Trial. The trial focused the intense national debate about whether public schools should teach biblical creationism or scientific evolutionism. High school teacher John Scopes was on trial in Tennessee for teaching evolution. The attorney Clarence Darrow, who represented Mr. Scopes, had strong connections with Unitarian churches, Unitarians around the country supported the case. And this was science and religion helping to unravel the mysteries of where we come from. Where do we come from? What are we? In 1930, Unitarian astronomer Clyde Tombaugh discovered Pluto. The UU Church of Las Cruces, where he was a member, has this gorgeous, you have to check it out if you're ever close by, gorgeous glass window depicting Pluto, small brown, purple, icy globe. Now, Pluto was officially declassified as a planet. And I actually do not feel that was a case of religious persecution against Unitarians. But it was a hard hit. It was not religious persecution, but it was a hard hit to the Unitarian people. I felt it. But Tombaugh discovering Pluto was science and religion, helping us unravel the mysteries of where we are in the surrounding cosmos. The spiritual theme of the month is hope. How do science and religion, when they're working well together, give you hope? Think about it. Of course, scientific advancements do not always engender hope. One crucial voice speaking to scientific shortcomings was Robert Oppenheimer, chief of the team which invented the atomic bomb. Oppenheimer lamented how those physicists on his team came to participate directly in sin, his own word, through their work of creating the world's most devastating weapon. But Oppenheimer never lost his fervent belief that the scientific method is absolutely critical for the human project, for improving our quality of life, and I agree with that. And like Dr. King says, we have the obligation to make choices based on wisdom and values. We, having invented weapons, have to work to make the world safer. We, having invented cell phones, which help poor people have a better life, have to turn off our phones and our computers and our TVs in order to stay in tune with nature and relationships and ourselves. Got to turn off the screen sometimes. Paul Tatey is chair of our humanist group here at the church, and he often helps me think about the relationship between religion and science. Paul notes that chemistry and pharmacology bring hope. In 1990, the top three causes of death were pneumonia, flu, tuberculosis, and digestive disease, all of which are treated now with vaccines and antibiotics. Up to 3 million lives are saved a year with those advancements. Religion should care. Agriculture brings hope. Improvements in fertilizers have increased crop production over fourfold in the last 100 years. We have better capacity to make quality food to distribute it. Now we just have to do that. Physics and electricity bring hope. for hydroelectric dams that give power to entire villages, life-saving hospital equipment. Scientific advancements are bringing renewable energy and clean water to save lives all around the world, and we should care. It should be talked about in the pulpit. And this month, large numbers of scientists around the country and the globe are declaring that the discipline and practice of science are under siege, and we should stand in support of that effort. This week, Reuters reported that on the official White House website, a page devoted to climate change has been taken down and put in the archives, hidden away. The web page, which the White House took down, displayed the work scientists have recorded, like 2016 being the hottest year on record, and government initiatives trying to combat the issue. Unfortunately, Mr. Scott Pruitt, the new head of the EPA, said in testimony to Congress, it's irrelevant what he believes about the cause of climate change. As the head of the EPA, that sounds like a man who's not focused on the value of science. People of faith in churches, synagogues, and mosques should stand firmly in support of science being used to improve the quality of our lives. Thankfully, we have many spiritual giants to look to for inspiration. In 1962, for example, naturalist and science writer Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. Carson warned that pesticides like DDT were being sprayed excessively in attempts to control crop pests. Poisons were being washed into waterways and moved along the food chain, threatening delicate ecosystems, birds, fish, humans. The EPA, created in 1970 under Richard Nixon, took heed of the warning and banned DDT in 72. We need to engage our hearts and our minds and our souls in the courageous work, continuing the work of putting accurate information and wisdom and ethics into making tough decisions. People are standing up all over the place in public witness. Last week, we had two buses of folks who went down to D.C. I know at least dozens, if not 100 of our folks went downtown to Philly for public witness. We had people in L.A. and Boston out in the streets for justice and reason and using intelligent methods, counting facts to help make the world a better place. It's difficult work. It's difficult because not only at times we have to face down ill-conceived policies in the government, but also multinational corporations. It's also difficult because at times we're going to have to give up our comfort and our privilege and our addiction. Comfort, privilege, and addiction. Just because science gives us all these ways of being doesn't mean it's right. We have to use our wisdom and our ethics and our daily life and help each other. The good news is you can feed your soul to do the strong work. Many ways. Feed your soul. Science, being engaged with it, is one way to feed your soul so you can be strong. Amateur astronomer John Lowry Dobson died 2 years ago at the age of 98. One major factor in his happy longevity was stargazing. He loved to watch the sky and the stars. Mr. Dobson's life passion was encouraging wide ranges of people to stargaze. He invented a low-budget telescope for the purpose of making the cosmos available for more people. If you get a chance to take a look through a telescope, do it. Do it. And while you're looking, try to wrap your head around the fact that the most current estimates calculate there are 100 to 200 billion galaxies in the universe, each of which has hundreds of billions of stars. Okay, just look up tonight if you want. And remember, there are estimated 100 to 200 billion galaxies in the universe, each of which has hundreds of billions of stars. And you can always just do this with your naked eye. Look at the sky tonight and also contemplate the fact that there are very high odds that the conditions needed for life exist in millions of other planets. That brings me awe and wonder to live, to be excited, to be hopeful. Maybe life is beginning on another planet right now. Quote your preacher on that one, people. Maybe life is beginning on another planet right now. Right here, right now, we know for sure that we can learn new things, feel wonder, and hope. Science and religion together help us to see into the majesty and mystery of all. This energizes us to live with generosity. If we're open to step into a new way of seeing and understanding the world,